And I can't gonna freestyle stall a little bit.
Hi there, folks. How's everyone doing? Today we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Smithsonian Folklife Festival here on the Mall. 50 years of Folklife Festival. To keep you in mind, we have Circus Arts. You can hear that Calliope. That's going on for a little while. We'll have On the Move, Personal Meets the Political, with policy considerations and personal narratives coming up really soon. So, stay hydrated. Hang out with folks. We'll be here soon. Feel free to move up. We have a lot of spaces. Feel free to move up for the next session, please. Come on up, come move forward. It's 4th of July. It's hot, but you know, if you keep your mind cool, then you can weather through it. So, where is everyone from today? Folks haven't already visited the Arts and Industries building, it's just right across the mall, next to the castle. There's a marketplace there. You can buy all kinds of incredible musical gifts, books, artifacts, textiles, jewelry, all kinds of great stuff there. A lot of it also featured by the Heritage Fellows that have been performing with us and been featured. So make sure you make your way over to the marketplace today. Yeah, I like this music. Good, keep that going, yeah.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Hello. I am Perla Guerrero. I'm Assistant Professor of American Studies and Latino Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. And I am a scholar of race, labor, and migration. So it's my pleasure to be here to facilitate this panel discussion, intersection of personal stories and immigration policy. So I'm going to let everyone introduce themselves. But the idea behind this panel is to get a little bit more information about immigration, displacement, movement, something beyond the typical kind of expected story of looking for a better life. Because policy is very important in defining who can enter the country, who cannot, who can stand in a so-called line, who can quote unquote do it the right way. A quick little bit of information is just that there are usually numerical limits on countries of origin. And there are different numbers for different countries, there are different considerations, depending on if there's an environmental disaster, if there's a war, the United States position on a war determines whether people being displaced by war are actually recognized as refugees or not. In this area, some of you might know that there are a lot of Central American Americans that were displaced due to civil wars in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Guatemala, but many of them were not ever recognized as refugees, meaning that they had to enter as undocumented immigrants. And so they have US citizen children, but they're divided along legal status, undocumented citizen, right? That's because the US didn't recognize a lot of the civil wars, and so thus didn't assign them a category of refugees. So I'm gonna let everyone introduce themselves. We're going to start with Brenda Perez Amador, and then Kumera Ganet, and then Ted Gong. And I've asked them to just share a little bit about themselves, who they are, and a little bit about their family's migration story. Thank you.
So thank you, everybody, for being here. My name is Brenda Perez. I'm originally from Mexico, but I've been in D.C. for pretty much half of my life. So I'm kind of like a Mexican Washingtonian. And right now, I'm studying at the University of the District of Columbia. I'm doing civil engineering as my major. And I'm also a youth activist here in D.C. I do campaigns for language access to give quality education for English language learners in the D.C. public system. And I also do a lot of campaigning towards immigration reform. And the main reason why I came to the United States was because there were a lot of family issues. Back in Mexico, still right now, the police is very corrupt, and the government is really corrupt as well. So my dad worked for the police department, and he started to become so corrupt that kind of mentality that he had in the workplace started to follow into the home. So he started to be very abusive, not very supportive financially or emotionally. So my mom, being the strong woman that she is, she said, I can't live with you anymore. I have to take my children with me. So we lived with my grandmother for a couple of years until my mom faced another challenge where she couldn't find work. And 10 years ago or 11 years ago, it was really hard for a woman to find work in Mexico, especially since she didn't have a college education and she was a single mother. It's very typical back in our home countries, when you go to an interview, they ask you, are you married? Or how many children do you have? Because they kind of want to lay your intellectuality based on your husband or something like that. So it was very hard for her to find a job. And she decided to come to the United States because this is where the dream was. My father was here long before my mother came here, so he was able to establish a space, a house, and when my mom decided that she wanted to come, he opened his house for us here in D.C. She came here, and then 2 years later, she decided that me and my siblings would come here as well because things in Mexico were not looking as good. But yeah, that's a little bit about why I came here.
All right, I'm Kumara Zacharias Ganet. I'm from Austin, Texas originally. My family is from Ethiopia. Both of my parents came to the U.S. in the early 1970s to mid-70s. My dad finished high school here in the United States. He left Ethiopia in 1973, I believe, and he was a student protester at the time. He was protesting against the government, Haile Selassie. It was a very large student protest movement, and he was put in jail twice. And there was a very palpable fear for his life when he left. So through the missionary services, he was able to find a way out of the country to go to school here, to finish school, and then eventually go to college. And then my mother came on a student visa. So I grew up in Austin, Texas, in a predominantly Mexican immigrant and Mexican-American community. I've worked in education and youth development for 10 years, first starting here in D.C. in the Columbia Heights neighborhood in Northwest D.C. Most of my students and the families that I worked with were from El Salvador, but there was also large populations of students from the Dominican Republic, African-American students, Ethiopian students, and Guyanese. So it was a wonderful neighborhood. It's changed a lot since when I first started working there, and a lot of those families don't live there anymore. But I've continued working in youth development, and now I'm at a national organization planning events and writing curricula for first-generation college students and first-generation Americans.
So my name is Ted Gong, and I was born in the United States, so I didn't come here as an immigrant. And in fact, I'm the fourth or fifth generation Chinese American. My great-grandfather actually came working here, and things like he wasn't in the gold mines, he wasn't in the railroads, he was out there shucking potatoes in San Francisco Bay. And then my father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were born here. My mother came here after the war as a bride of an American citizen. My career is a little bit different from these people. I'm actually a retired Foreign Service officer. I've been 30 years working with the State Department and U.S. Immigration Service, and most recently I was seconded out to Homeland Security, Customs Border Protection. I worked on the 1986-89 reforms, actually, and worked on the most recent reforms, and back before it was still being considered as passable before it collapsed completely. So right now I am in charge of a foundation. We call it the 1882 Foundation. 1882 is the year in which the first Comprehensive Immigration Act was passed. In the year 1882, Congress passed the law to prohibit Chinese from immigrating to the United States or becoming American citizens. Based purely on race, you cannot come to the United States because you're a Chinese. My mother was affected by that, and I could tell that story later for you. But anyway, we've created a foundation which is called the 1882 Foundation. I'm the executive director, and what we do is we try to educate the public about the significance of the 1882 laws. We want to talk about Chinese American history. We do this through oral histories and preservation historical sites. We do workshops for teachers, curriculum reform, try to introduce the topic of exclusion acts into the curriculum. And we also do annual gatherings of museums, Asian American museums, and historical societies, and try to share best practices. So I look forward to continuing the discussion with all of you.
Wonderful. The next question that I thought we would talk about is a little bit about the context in the country or area of origin. Political issues, economic issues, environmental issues. And if you have any ideas about the relationship to the United States. And Ted, since you just mentioned Chinese exclusion and how your organization is trying to introduce that into curricula, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that. Chinese exclusion in the United States, how Chinese immigrants were able to enter during exclusion, and then why you think it's important for school-aged children to learn that history. And then we'll kind of work our way down the panel.
So there's a whole host of issues there, everything from the very origins of immigration law, the whole immigration bureaucracy, the way we have a sort of a antagonistic relationship between the applicant and the government workers, all actually stems from the 1882 Act, if you really want to think about it. In fact, not very many people know this, but the Mounted Border Patrol, which we think about that's patrolling the Mexican border, is actually formed to prevent Chinese from trying to sneak across from Mexico into the United States to avoid the 1882 laws. The 1882 law was passed to do two things: prevent Chinese from immigrating to the United States by their race, prevent them from becoming American citizens, also by race. That law was renewed three times. In 1882, it was passed for 10 years. And pay attention to some of the vocabulary that is used. It was meant to be a temporary exclusion, expedient thing. It then was approved 10 years later in 1892, and then was approved again 10 years later in 1902 and made permanent. So if people talk about today about temporary revisions of law, you need to be a little bit cautious of what that actually means. The 1882 laws, completely race-based, was not rescinded until 1943. And in 1943, they rescinded because of United States was in a war with Japan, and China was our ally. So you couldn't really fight a war against fascism and say you those people that were your partners could not come to the United States. So the question then is, how do people come? And despite the laws, my father was able to come, different people were able to come, and we have things like people are trying to pretend they were American. You couldn't prevent Americans, people who were born in the United States, to be American citizens. In fact, actually, the birthright citizenship was determined by a Chinese exclusion case. It was a case by a guy named Wong Kim Art, who was born in Modesto, California, went to China, and then came back. And the Chinese immigration officials tried to exclude him because he should be an aunt. He was born to immigrants in the United States who are not eligible, undocumented aliens, right? They're undocumented people.
Right.
So birthright citizenship was actually determined in a Supreme Court case brought to court by a Chinese person. And Chinese person established the 14th Amendment was, if you're born in the United States, you're a citizen. So you need to be cautious, too, that I think one of the most dangerous things that are facing immigration today is actually not totally the prohibition about people coming to the United States temporary, but the attack on potential birthright citizenship. So if anybody is looking around right now and say, we need to review that case, because the case in the Supreme Court was a split decision, actually, although for the last 100 plus years, everybody assumes that birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment is secure. I think that if the Congress or other people want to pass a legislation that tests the case, the purpose is to bring it to the Supreme Court for another decision of that, there is a possibility that you can lose birthright citizenship. Birthright citizenship is not something that many countries in the modern world actually have. Mm-hmm. So it's not unusual for other countries to say, we don't recognize birth simply by the fact that you're born within our territories. So we need to be careful about those things, those implications are there. So paper sons, undocumented people, we now celebrate a lot of the people that come here, pretend that they are Americans or they had other citizenship. My mother tried to come here when she was 16 years old, and she couldn't come in the United States. She was held at Angel Island, which was an immigration detention center on San Francisco Bay. They say it's the Ellis Island of the West, mm-hmm. but actually it was designed to detain and hold Chinese people to exclude them. My mother came there in May 1937 on a ship. She came here by herself. She stayed there for 11 months before she was deported back to China. So she couldn't get in the United States. And that's something to think about and what we mean by who we exclude and how we can. There's an immigration law I remember looking at now that says if you try to enter the United States by pretending that you are an American citizen, then you are ineligible for life. That's one of the provisions in our current immigration law. And I thought to myself, you know, if that law had been in place when my mother tried to enter, and she tried to enter when she was trying to pretend that she was another person that was born in the United States, she would have been not able to come to the United States. I would not be here. I wouldn't be here talking
right.
to you guys.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's some background.
Yeah, thank you. There's a book, for those of you interested on immigration in the West, there is a book on Angel Island, and particularly the way it was used to detain Asian immigrants that were trying to enter the United States. And the other thing that Ted mentioned that I just wanted to really call your attention to is the fact that when we talk about so-called anchor babies today, children born to undocumented immigrants, it was an Asian American person that was the first quote-unquote anchor baby, because that Supreme Court case was about whether that person was actually a U.S. citizen because he was born in the United States. So we also need to think about the way in which ideas about race or immigration or immigrants change over time, how we kind of displace our anxieties about race, indifference, or the economy onto different groups of people at particular times. Kumaira, I wonder if you could share a little bit about do you know about your families, like your parents, how they got their student visas? Was it easy? Was it difficult? Do you have a sense of whether many other people had the same opportunity or whether just things kind of lined up for your parents?
Yeah, sure. I can talk about that. I don't know a lot. And I think that's common. The process is very complicated. What a lot of, I think, parents in particularly the Ethiopian community want to do, there's a strong feeling of protecting your child. Like, I was born here, and so it's almost like this is just another burden as a parent that I don't want to pass on to my child, right? They never really wanted to get in the ins and outs of that. And I found a couple of things. My father actually passed away earlier this year. And so I was looking through a lot of his documents, and I found like just this big box full of INS documents and stuff like that, going back to the early 70s, bank ledgers of when he was sending money back to Ethiopia when he was a student in college. And it's something that I think because of the, like I was saying, the very strong need for them to want their children, like myself, to assimilate, that there isn't as much information shared. I know more about my extended family who came as refugees than I actually know about my parents. A lot of my families who came to this area in particular, because I grew up in Texas, a lot of my family members started coming to DC in the 90s. And they were coming from Ethiopia by way of Kenya and Tanzania. So they were passing through Nairobi, and then over there, that's when they would get to the UNHCR office. And so on that side of my family, they come from a group called the Oromo people in Ethiopia, who were, for people who were politically involved and families who were politically involved like mine, number one, they had the access and the ability to leave the country and the privilege to be able to do that. And number two, it was recognized in the East African UNHCR policy, the UN High Commission for Refugees, that they were a targeted group. And so in that time period, it was possible for them to get refugee papers and to come directly to the United States.
Did they have to have sponsors in the U.S. as refugees?
Mm-hmm, and they did. And there was a previous generation among Ethiopians. I don't want to make quick and hard rules here, but in this, Ethiopians first started coming to the D.C. area in the 50s, many as students and diplomats. Mm-hmm. The 60s and 70s, a lot more who were from more well-to-do families came to the area. That includes my parents' generation and my parents standing in Ethiopia at the time. And then in the 80s, when the Civil War started going on, is when more people started coming as refugees. And then in the 90s, that continued until the 90s and 2000s, when a lot are refugees, and also through the diversity visa program.
Right.
So the sponsors were the more well-to-do uncles, cousins, mm-hmm. or whoever who had made roots here earlier. So.
Right. So for those of you that don't know, when you are actually in a country abroad and you're actually recognized as a refugee, as a persecuted group, the United Nations has to deem you a persecuted group, right? Due to race, religion, ethnicity, that also is tied into larger issues around policy. But once you actually are a refugee, you have to then wait for a U.S. sponsor that takes financial responsibility for you and or your family. So in this case, aunties, uncles would say to U.S. Immigration Service, I will sponsor, I will take on my niece, my nephew, I'm financially responsible for them until they get on their feet. I will enroll them in school. I will help them find a job. Sometimes, and this changes, it fluctuates, but one of the privileges of being a refugee, if you can call it that, even though people are fleeing war and terror and other issues, is that the U.S. government does provide some services class, English language classes, job training, possibly rent subsidies, in addition to the sponsor who takes on the responsibility. This is one of the largest differences between refugees and undocumented immigrants. Refugees have legal status, which means they can, if they can find a job, they can get a job. Undocumented immigrants do not have a legal status in the United States, which means they often have to break another law to get false documentation or work under the table. So, and they also rely on family networks that unofficially kind of sponsor them, but there's no kind of safeguard in place. So one of the other things that Kamara said that's really important is that, largely speaking, whether you're looking at Latin America, at Cuba, at Nigeria, the first cohorts, the first and second cohorts of people fleeing political turmoil or economic crisis are the elite, are the wealthy people of those countries. For Cuba, the Golden Exiles in the late 50s, 1960s were people with money. Same thing for Nigeria. And you start to see the repercussions of this when their U.S.-born children become really successful, right? Those of you that are familiar with the idea of the model minority, it's like they did it. You, the rest of you, poor people, should be able to do it too. A lot of the people that made it, that are the children, are actually children of very educated people in their countries of origin. So they're the children of doctors or professionals in a way that a lot of undocumented children from Laos, from Vietnam, from Thailand, from Mexico, Guatemala are not. Their parents are not highly educated, in addition to the immigration issues that are present. So that's also one of the things that really structures immigration in the United States, is a parent's educational attainment in their country of origin, whether they're literate in their native language, on top of any legal issues present. What do you want to tell us a little bit more about Mexico, the any kind of like political issues? You touched upon the kind of corruption. Anything else that you want to share about the context and kind of like as a push factor, right? Why people leave?
So I think very generally, a lot of the stuff that happens here in the U.S. Directly impacts Mexico. So if the U.S. starts to have an immigration problem, then they kind of look at Mexico and they're like, well, it's your people. And then Mexico will say, okay, I don't think it's our people, but it's maybe like people coming from other countries crossing Mexico to get to your country. So we see a lot of that stuff. When the U.S. started to have a lot of youth that were coming here undocumented, and this was a couple of years ago, they were coming from Central America. And what Mexico did and retaliation to that, I guess, is that the border patrol, because Mexico also has a border patrol between Central America, Guatemala, and Mexico, is that they started to reinforce it to prevent those people from coming into Mexico so that Mexico kind of doesn't get blamed for these immigration issues. Also, a lot with drugs. When the U.S. needs drugs, or when they start to have a problem with drugs, then Mexico gets pointed at it and like, oh, well, it's your people again. And the government start to take a lot of action into that. They start to do a lot of more repercussions and more stuff. But again, the corruption in Mexico is due to a lot of that stuff, people taking power. So yeah, I don't really know much about Mexico. I only grew up there until I was 10 years old, but all of that stuff is very, like, it prevails. It's still prevailing, and it's a lot of stuff that is still very noticeable. Up to this date, my grandmother talks about all of the Salvadorians who come into our neighborhood because we're in the capital, and she tells me stories about how they're also getting kicked out, how immigration is also looking for them, and how a lot of them have to work under the table in Mexico, and how a lot of them have very difficult issues trying to learn Spanish. Because believe it or not, a lot of the Central Americans that come in through Mexico, most of them are from indigenous cultures. So Spanish, it may not necessarily be their first language. So it's interesting to see how we have a lot of this immigration stuff and government corruption is very similar in Mexico and here in the United States. It's kind of like the same girl with a different dress, you know? Like, we still have language problems, immigration problems. There is still a lot of racism, a lot of language access problems and stuff like that.
Thank you. Okay, final question for the panel, and then we'll take some audience questions. Very quickly, is there anything else that you want the audience to know about? It can be about immigration. It could be about the personal meeting policy or your family's country of origin or area of origin. Basically, what do you want the audience to know that they might not get in very many other places? Does anybody have
so,
an idea?
So, you know, I do want to sort of like broaden the discussion a little bit. You know, we talk about migration and we talk about immigration. We talk about them coming over here. And we're trying to understand the reasons for people to come. And I think it's very human for us to really understand that these issues, whether it's government corruption, a war, or poverty, or whether these are not things that are just that are alien to the United States. If you think about the mass migrations from the South to the North, that was a huge, significant movement of American people because of the conditions in the South and the prospects and hopes that you have when you have the big northern migration. But you think about the Okies and Arkies that left the big Dust Bowl period and came across Route 66. All the human stories and all those things, they're very understandable. You don't have to go to find a foreign reason for people to come here. The difference, I think, in some of the things we do in immigration is that we actually set rules at a national policy deciding who can come and who cannot come. So I just want to go a little bit further in this issue. One of the things we did on the 1882 Foundation, the reason we got formed was because we organized a group nationwide to try to get Congress to apologize or acknowledge that they did wrong in the 1882 Act. There's nothing more, it was so fundamentally racist. It basically said, if you're Chinese, you cannot come to the United States except for a couple of exceptions, and you could not become an American citizen only because you're a Chinese. In the immigration records that I saw at San Bruno from my mother, big files like that, the one document was the final document that said, cause for exclusion, alien is a person of the Chinese race and therefore ineligible to become an American. And signed by the San Francisco District Director at the Immigration Department, that time it was the Department of Labor. But the issue for us is that these things have happened in the past. In the 1882 project, we got Congress to apologize, basically, for having passed those laws. And the question comes forth, why do we want to do that? It's something that was rescinded. It happened over 130 years ago. Chinese Americans are almost the model minority to come up here. The laws about race aren't there anymore. Why do this? And the answer is the stock answer you have. We need to do this so that Congress can learn from its past. We cannot build the future. We do not understand the past. We don't want to repeat the past mistakes. But I would say that there is an other issue. There's a deeper way to understand that. I think that the criticism we got during the 1882 project was that I don't want to talk about the past. I want to talk about the future. Yeah, there was mistakes, but let's build forward, go forward together. I think you still need to pass these types of laws, whether it's an apology for slavery or the Japanese internment or for the roundup of the Native Americans. You have to pass it. And there's actually only four apologies ever passed. Native Americans, internment, something about slavery, and something about the Native Americans and the Chinese Americans. The issue there is not that we are trying to apologize, single out the past and single out the victims of past laws so that we don't repeat it for the next decade, whether that's the Sikh Americans, the Filipino Americans, the Japanese internment, or the Mexican Americans today, or Muslims. The reason you pass it is because you have Congress, and we got Congress to pass these legislations by unanimous vote in the Senate and the House, two separate actions. unanimously. It's quite remarkable at the time when people don't even talk to each other. And the reason you pass it, because we were made, the issue was not an immigration issue. The issue was a civil rights issue. And what does it mean to be an American? And what, by passing these type of laws, you force Congress, who represents all of the Americans and has to respond to their constituents, to say, we need to spend time in Congress to pass these laws, because by passing them, or these apologies, you use a standard that says, I reaffirm our founding principles, the 14th Amendment. That reaffirmation is for all Americans. It's not just for the victims of that period. So it is a very forward-looking policy. You're saying that we might have forgot it sometime, but here in 2011 and 2012, we reaffirm the Constitution and our founding principles. That's for all of us. That affects all Americans. But I would say that that kind of apology goes one step further. You apologize for being American, but if I ask you guys, or you, or these people, do you know what your past is? If you don't know what your past is, what your history was, if you are denied that history, if you don't know about these laws, a portion of you is missing, right? You're allowing somebody else to tell you what is important in the history that made you and you and you. That is a civil right. That's a civil rights issue. I should know my history. I should be allowed to hear my history. The schools should not exclude it, whether they do it purposely, or our societies and our communities should not do it because they're just ignorant. They just don't know. We need to tell the people. And it should be us to tell it. We need to tell in our own words so we can say that not somebody else is telling me what I am and who I am. I will tell myself, and I will make a decision what is important to me. And to do that, we have to know our history. We have to confront our history. So that's the sort of thought.
Thank you. Other comments?
Yeah, just three things. Migration and immigration are not an easy subject. And that said, we need to educate ourselves. We need to educate ourselves in knowing that there is no line that immigrants can go to and just apply for citizenship status. It's not like that. It's very complicated. And get ourselves educated in all of the programs that the U.S. implements for immigrants, for undocumented folk, for refugees, and how they work. And that each time they implement something, that is not necessarily a victory, because like we learned from the refugee program, it only benefits the elite. And when it comes to undocumented folk, there's a program that is called DACA, which it gives a work permit and a social security number for undocumented youth that came without them knowing that they were coming into the United States. But still, those programs don't benefit the large population of undocumented folk, and it doesn't fix the refugee problems that we have.
And so they're temporary. DACA is temporary.
And DACA is very temporary. It's only for 2 years, and every time it expires, you have to reapply, and you have to pay a lot of money to get that kind of documentation back. So it doesn't benefit anybody. And in order to get yourself educated again, or the last piece of advice that I have for you guys, is to get involved in the community, work with local nonprofits that are doing this work, talk to folk who are affected by these issues, and try to see how you can get involved, if it's financially, if it's helping them with any resources or any kind of information that you may have. So, yeah.
Okay. It's kind of a hard question. There's a couple of things. One thing I want to point out is that both immigration, refugee policy, the push factors, we are still recovering from a lot of the pain and suffering of the Cold War throughout the world. My family, the civil war in Ethiopia was part of the Cold War. For Salvadorians, Nicaraguans, it's not that these conflicts wouldn't have happened, but would they have been sustained to such a level with so many arms and these kind of things escalating and pushing hundreds of thousands and millions of people out of multiple countries, it would not have been at this level. And that's a direct part of the vestiges of U.S. foreign policy and Russian foreign policy and other actors. And so that stuff doesn't go away. I went to Ethiopia for the first time in 1994. That was 2 years after the war ended. And you could still see the impact of that in so many places. You could still see, bullet holes in the... It's just like... So I empathize so much, particularly with Central Americans, in part because of my experience working with that community here in D.C., and also because I know what it feels like. I know what it's like for that to be your family. And so we have to very much keep that in mind, both in what we advocate for in immigration policy, but also how foreign policy will end up impacting immigration policy in the future. The other point is, I just want to explicitly say this, immigration issues are black issues also. I'm black, and my parents always raised me to be very thankful and grateful for the sacrifices that a lot of communities made. I'm learning about the history of organizing that the Chinese American community has done, and also for the black community that's helped open the doors for us to come here as immigrants after the 1960s. And in any part of the immigration discussion, there are black issues. In the ban, in the travel ban that affects Sudan and Somalia also, those are black countries. And so that visibility isn't always acknowledged when folks are talking about immigration. And that needs to be acknowledged and explicitly stated also. That also relates to policing. I grew up in a black and brown community. So that extends where the criminal justice system is often a mechanism for putting predominantly young men into immigration detention and other things for very minor offenses, like in Brooklyn, jumping a turnstile on the subway. So we have to also make sure that we keep that in mind and be inclusive and continue to frame our immigrants for who and what we are.
Right. On that note, for those of you that don't know, undocumented black immigrants are disproportionately deported in relationship to other immigrants. And the reason for that is because they are stopped more frequently by the police for jumping the turnstile, and thus their intersection with racial profiling in the United States and their immigration status leads them to be disproportionately deported. So this is a very kind of crystal clear intersection of race and immigration status. Okay, does anybody have questions? Anything you wanna know about? Questions. Yes. So the question is, what does that look like, the intersection of the black community with immigration issues? Since when we talk about immigration, it's often as if we are excluding black people. So what is the question is to Kamara?
Okay, well, I think part of how you do it is what, number one, be inclusive, having people like me on discussions like this. I think it's something that's largely, in my opinion, from outside of the black immigrant community and black communities. I think if I'm walking down the street, I grew up here in the United States. I'm very happy, and I am, and I identify as black, as do my parents and my family. I think that not acknowledging black immigrants as immigrants is, how do I put it? Like, I grew up where I grew up because of housing discrimination, not necessarily because of anti-immigrant discrimination, but because in Austin, it was very difficult for black families to get a home west of the highway. So I think, and I do work at an immigrant civil rights organization or a Latino civil rights organization that's very involved in immigration issues. And when we talk about some of the things I was saying, like policing in communities, housing discrimination, quality education, I think it's, to be honest, more incumbent on the immigrants' rights organizations to make sure that they're inclusive of that. And then I would also, I think it's more on the communities that are doing immigrants organizing to be sure to be inclusive of that, to talk about that, than it is particularly on us to be visible. I always say I'm a first generation American, I'm black.
Right. So there's an assumption in the question that there are people who are immigrants coming in and there's the white group of people. Mm-hmm. It's how you have defined what is American, right? So you need to look at that assumption first. And then immigration policy and how you bring that in is actually a separate, is another issue.
Okay, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're out of time. I'm sorry. If you have a burning question, we're going to be off to the side. You can come and approach us, and we'll be happy to talk to you a few minutes. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay tuned for the next panel.
From this.